The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to Stephen Yu of Bluewell, one of the UK's finest large cap growth investors. So welcome, Stephen.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, well, we've had a really strong start to the year. We've had NASDAQ up over 10%. I'm sure Bluewell has also done pretty well on the back, actually, of it's a really strong or blowout jobs report on Friday. So putting that together, what's your sort of outlook for equities going forward?
Yeah, it seems like the market's already got quite excited about 2023 versus 2022 last year. And I think, I mean, the market has reason why that has recovered a bit this year is just because something we talked about last year is about the relatively lower risk for interest rate increases. Of course, I mean, that's still not finished yet. But then as you compare to the beginning of last year versus sometime last year, I think the interest rate expectations have gone up dramatically from 1% to 5% at the terminal rate in the US. So I think that journey is probably done. And even though maybe inflation is still intact, that you don't expect the rates to go up from 5 to 10, isn't it? Like maybe 5 to 6 or maybe up to 7 or something. And so, So I think on that note, I think there's some reason for the market to get excited about. But of course, I mean, we probably are more focused on recession risk this year, which then maybe plays into better companies' investments.
Oh, and what about sort of like the valuation? Because of the NASDAQ now is on about 23, 24 times forward PE, which isn't exactly sort of like, you know, that cheap.
It's a difficult one because I share that some commentators would have suggested that the equities premium is still not attractive relative to, let's say, fixed income or bonds, just because that interest rate is much higher now compared to before. So you don't really get paid by investing into equities. But I think the one thing to note is if we believe that inflation is going to stay at a high level, not at 10%, but maybe, let's say, 3 to 4, maybe 4 to 5% over a sustained period of time, that fixed income is not a good hedge on inflation because you don't get, you get to pay a fixed coupon, but you don't grow that coupon in line with inflation. But on the other hand, you can argue that some equities or maybe some company, let's say MasterCard or Visa that we have, that their revenue would actually grow in line with inflation. So they would be a better hedge. So not sure whether that's what the market is seeing, but I think in some ways I agree that equity valuation is probably not at the most attractive point now compared to last year.
Yeah, in broad terms anyway, because I know you sort of like specialize in looking for sort of beautiful companies with long-term sort of secular growth and just positioning the sort of like the Bluewell portfolio over the next 5 years. Obviously, you know, the previous 5 years, I know you've had a sort of like, it's been slightly up and down. It was tough last year, but overall you've beaten the major indices. So that's been great. Now looking, say, further ahead, if we look towards, I don't know, 2027, 2028, how would you sort of like structure the sort of the portfolio?
Yeah, this is a very important thing that we have done last year or maybe 6 months before last year, was that when we first started 5 years ago, we started with a blank piece of paper, and how we ended up doing relatively well was because we spotted these opportunities in digital transformation, encompassing e-commerce, digital payments, digital advertising, software, cloud, and anything that you can think of. However, certain things have changed since late 2021, and we exited all the FANG names, as we already talked about, Facebook, Amazon, Google. On the other hand, that we, given the new world order, that we have gone into some new opportunities in the financial space, industrial, and also energy. So we think that in the next 5 years, the world in itself is quite uncertain, which means that anything that that is maybe consumer facing or maybe economically sensitive, that you need to be a bit cautious. But on the other hand, there are certain opportunities that would benefit on the back of this uncertain world order that give that is certainty of the free cash flow trajectory would be a lot higher compared to some of the FANG names.
And so throughout the portfolio, is he still looking for secular growth rather than cyclical growth, i.e. such the new sectors and more defensive, they've still got that secular tailwind? Is that what you're sort of like the thread between the whole of the sort of Bluewell portfolio?
Yes, we do still like secular growth. The way that we think about this is we want to invest into companies or sectors that would take a bigger share of the world GDP 5 years from today. So 5 years ago, sectors would be related to digital transformation. 5 years from today, we recognize that some industrial companies or even energy would take a bigger share because of the reshoring opportunities. At the same time, the geopolitics uncertainties.
Yeah. So that leads us perfectly into that sort of the latest purchase, your sort of energy play, the Canadian Natural Resources, which I think is sort of like a heavy oil play in Canada. Do you want to take us through the sort of the logic for that purchase?
Yeah. So we have kept an open mind going post the war in Ukraine. And of course, we recognize that certain things have changed in terms of how the energy prices might play out in the future years. And one thing that we recognize that in previous cycle is all about supply and demand. So let's say the economy is booming, then the oil price can go up to about $100. And if we are in a recession, then the oil price can reset back to 40 to 50. But because of the new geopolitics uncertainty, not just in Europe on the back of Russian invasion of Ukraine, at the same time, the geopolitics in Asia, given what China is probably doing in Taiwan, at the same time, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the US is no longer the same as before. So what it means is the oil price could be well supported at a higher level compared to the previous cycle, despite a recession would come at some point. That means if you can find a oil producer, which is Canadian Natural Resources, the one that we have identified, that have a very long life reserve of asset, is about 40 years that they can run down the reserve. At the same time, the cost of production for a barrel of oil would be sub $30-$40, which means if you can have the oil price being stabilized at about 70 to 80, they could theoretically generate a lot of free cash flow back to shareholders in terms of dividends or buybacks. And this is the thing that I was talking about earlier, that it doesn't, you don't need the world to go in a certain direction in terms of whether we are in recession or not in recession. I think they could still be able to generate that amount of free cash flow for shareholders, which is the certainty or the higher level, a higher probability that it will be able to achieve that than maybe some consumer facing tech businesses.
Yeah. And why did you choose the sort of tar sands, the heavier oil? Is that largely sort of like because the Russian distillates are being banned from they've been banned now on the market from the 5th of February? I was just wondering why you went for the heavier types of oil rather than the light sweet crude.
It's kind of in a way that what attracted us is the long life reserve of that.
Right. Okay.
That they have, so which is about 40 years. What it means is, We would prefer a company not to be spending a lot of money in investing into new asset base. So if your asset base, let's say maybe if you talk about like Shell Oil in the US, the depletion rate is pretty high. It's probably about maybe a quarter of the Shell Oil well would get depleted every year. So every 4 years that would be a new well, you need to drill in a new well. So of course, I mean, that would then feed back into the return on investor capital profile in terms of how much money you need to put into the future growth of the business. But as far as Canadian Natural Resources is concerned, because they have such a long life reserve that they don't need to put a lot of money back into growing the asset base. So I think in that sense, it makes the valuation and also return on investor capital profile pretty high compared to other players. At the same time, most of their asset base would be in North America, which is a region that we prefer on a high level, given a choice, and not in some South African or some random
more higher risk geopolitically stable.
So it's relatively stable in terms of where the asset is based. That is why we prefer them. But of course, I think one point I would make though is if you do believe the higher level thesis that oil price would remain a high level, of course, most of the energy company would make money. I mean, they would do pretty well just because that at Blue Well, we have a very high bar on the quality of the business, just like when we were investing into technology names, that this is the name that we have identified. So I'm sure people would have made money in BP or Shell, but we wouldn't have considered them for the Blue Well Growth Fund.
Yeah, okay, gotcha. Well, you've certainly got some really high quality stocks in healthcare, which is another sort of defensive secular grower, no doubt about it. In fact, they've done really well. I think we start off with Dexcom, which I think sort of like does continuous monitoring, sort of like diabetes or blood sugar levels in diabetes patients. Do you want to take us through this one? Because I think that's had a really good sort of like, you know, last 12 months, isn't it?
Yes, we do like the diabetes market as like a secular growth drivers. If you look at the world population in terms of how many people have some sort of diabetes syndrome, you're talking about a few hundred million people and at the same time is growing that number. So what Dexcom does is they have this device called glucose monitoring, that device that they put onto your arm or somewhere on your body, that instead of doing like a finger prick, like checking your glucose consumption, which is only like maybe a couple of times a day at a one single time in a day, that you can have like a continuous kind of series of showing you how much glucose level you have in your body. So for anyone who have some serious diabetes syndrome, it helped them to monitor their diet in terms of what they should do, or maybe do more exercises, etc. And then for people who might be in the type 2 that are not as serious, I think it even helped them not to then get into the type 1 kind of, which is more serious. And so what happened in the US is last year they started to expand in terms of the healthcare coverage. They started to expand the coverage to people in the type 2 space, that if you need to take a couple of times of insulin a day just to stabilize your glucose level, then you'll be eligible to get the Dexcom devices from the healthcare insurers. So that has just started. So basically what it means is they are now gradually expanding into the type 2. So if you're type 1, you likely to be using the Dexcom devices already. But then if you're type 2, typically if you don't get the subsidy from the healthcare insurers or the government, you might not want to do it because it will cost you a few thousand pounds a year. Mm. And at the same time, the Dexcom is a US company, is about $60 billion company, is relatively big. At the same time, they're growing into the G7 market. So if you go into NHS, you would have you would also have access to the Dexcom devices, and also in the case in Japan. So they're expanding their territory into other developed market, which we would think they would share the similar dynamics as what they have got in the US.
They've got their latest new product as well being launched, I think, into the US, isn't it? It just needs sort of like, you know, that. I think that's in Q1. It's already gone live with the NHS. So I did see the organic growth of this for the next few years from analysts is sort of 20-25% per annum. So it's absolutely going to, you know, growing to the moon as much as anything. I was just wondering, when it comes to sort of valuation, when do you decide to sort of like take profits on it? Because it's done really, really well, but it's actually trading at about 11 times sales. Given it's going to grow into that, I know, I get it, and it's a winner. I mean, how do you view sort of like, you know, taking profits on companies that are doing really well for you?
In the context of Dexcom, it would be a bit different to some other names that we have. This is one of those very typical secular growth story that the TAM in itself today is very, very small in terms of like the number of devices they're selling is only a couple of million, but it could be tens of millions in the next few years or 10 years. I think how we get comfortable with the valuation, if we are really, if we really like the technology in itself in terms of competitive positioning, that's not like an imminent competitors coming in to take the share or disrupt the market for Dexcom, then at the same time that we could see like a clear trajectory in terms of how much more market share they can take when they expand into G7 or type 2 and all other places, then that's how you probably could make the most money if you hold a share for a long period of time. So Dexcom, in its context, it's not, I mean, of course, people can maybe take some profit now, maybe buy back later, but sometimes it's quite difficult that this could last for many years, theoretically, if they continue to grow into the market. Of course, if their technology doesn't work or someone come up with a better technology, then that's a risk, which is something that we monitor quite closely. Though this is not a typical buy and hold company that you can just buy and forget about them and come back maybe 5 years later. As far as the technology is concerned, you need to monitor the development, whether it continue to be like a top choice for anyone who want to get that device. And if you're happy with that thesis, then the valuation will sort itself out over time.
Yeah, okay.
So this is not like a typical cyclical company that you trade in and out in the cycle, because the cycle theoretically is going to get much better for Dexcom.
Yeah, gotcha. So don't trade it, just buy it and invest it. Okay, now Sartorius, which is another one we talked about, which does sort of effectively equipment and machines which go into helping, I think, lots of pharmaceuticals, you know, sort of pharmaceutical companies make biotechs, so biosimilars and also vaccines and stuff like that, in that clean environment, and then also a bunch of lab equipment and stuff like that. So it really seems to have a huge sort of defensive economic moat. Yeah, can you take us through the latest one? Another one which has done really well for you.
Yes, we do actually like Sartorius a lot. It's on our top 10 holdings. Mm. The reason we like about this is they sell the equipment to basically in the biologics.
Biologics market. Yeah.
And what attracted us is basically if you have to develop, let's say, the COVID drug or anything that related to biologics, is the equipment itself or the production process itself for the drug would be spec into your kind of approval. Mm. So when you go to the FDA to say, oh, I want to seek the approval for my drug, you need to spec the whole production process. Yeah. And then if, let's say, Sartorius equipment has been selected as part of the spec, then it means that recurring revenue stream could last for maybe at least like 10, 20 years, depending on what sort of drug we're talking about. And then the other thing, what attracted us to Sartorius is, if you look at the biologics market, which is obviously has been used in the COVID vaccine, that's the reason why we managed to get a vaccine out so quickly, that it's only about 1/3 of the market today in terms of how, but the overall production of drugs in the world. And we do think that in the next 5 to 10 years, that number can get to over 50% or at least maybe 60-40 towards the biologics, which means that if you are in this fast-growing space, that they could be taking market share from the traditional drug producers as well. And you can see that the logic why this is happening. And so this is actually quite strong company. I think last year what was slightly confusing, if you look at the share price movement, I think there's certain period that has been quite volatile, is because the market, some part of the market were still under the impression Sartorius is about the COVID drugs. And when we have less COVID drugs production, then their earnings is going to decrease. But what we really want to see is the COVID vaccine kind of contribution to the revenue would disappear completely or remain a small part, and it doesn't cause any more volatility in the share price. But I think that's more noise than fundamentals, because that is low quality to start with. At the same time, that people shouldn't really be care about, oh, how many more COVID vaccine we're still going to produce in a year, because that is not what is driving the long-term story for Sartorius about the biologics kind of technology that's going to get more traction in terms of producing drugs.
Yeah, no, I'm totally in agreement. I think, you know, you've not only got obviously sort of like, you know, production of vaccines, which is getting more important, particularly the mRNA vaccines. I was actually on a conference call with Pfizer last week and listening to it, and they are very optimistic in terms of that whole mRNA vaccine going into sort of like, you know, cancer and into autoimmune diseases. And likewise, just to sort of add on to what you were saying with biologics and biosimilars, Humira, the world's largest drug, is coming off patent, and there's a whole bunch of guys, Pfizer included, who are building facilities to be able to do these biosimilars, which would require all Sartorius's equipment, I'm guessing. So I think you've definitely chosen a good one there. Now, Veeva's another one which has got sort of like a category killer in all things software related for sort of drug discovery, project management, and all this sort of stuff for the life sciences. Do you want to take us through this one? Because it's absolutely a top quality business.
Yes, we really like Veeva in a way that we don't directly invest into farmers or biotech companies. Of course, I mean, going back using Sartorius as an example, we don't need to spot the next winners in terms of the mRNA technology. Like, it could, that equipment could be used across different drugs in terms of the journey. And Veeva is a kind of like a vertically integrated software company for the healthcare market. So one piece of the software is the CRM, customer relationship management system, for the healthcare or drug or pharma reps to sell the drugs into clinics in the US, for example. So as you can imagine, it's a bit, the healthcare market is a bit like the financial services, that is highly compliance. Like you need to make sure like you have, the doctors are buying your drugs, that you have basically have your selling process is completely compliant, that you have to go through all the steps that you need to do. And at the same time, those steps and conversation would need to be recorded and logged, and to make sure that you haven't promised, over-promised what the drugs might do. And so Veeva produced the piece of software for the pharma's market. And if you look at their top 50 customers, that they basically sell to the Johnson & Johnson, Glaxo, Smith & Klein, and all the names that you think of, they would be using the software to do this, the pharma reps. The other part of the business is they also have a piece of software for the biotech industry to take a drug from stage zero to the drug, to the stage being approved. So what it means is, like, throughout that journey, of course, there will be many clinical trials, that many data need to be collected, different, like, different trial and error and all this experiments that need to be recorded. And by the time you get to the FDA stage, then all this would need to be shown in a, I'm sure that would be like hundreds, if not thousands of pages of documents. And you need some sort of software to document that journey. So that is something that we do like as well. The last part of the business, which is fairly new, I mean, it's been under development for the last few years, is they are also trying to bring this compliance software, part of the compliance software for the biotech, into other industries, such as the cosmetics industry.
Okay,
if you're producing some sort of like chemicals or maybe some cosmetics, like, they already have some customer trialing that out, but it's only a quite small part of the business now. But if it does work out, you can see that the TAM for this business could be huge, because any company that's producing some sort of consumer kind of products, in terms of things that we put it onto your body and faces and all that stuff, could be using this to log what has been gone through the stage.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. And as I say, it's an absolute industry dominating bit of software that everybody uses. Another one, actually, just on the software, which is an adjacent market, but does sort of similar a bit, is Autodesk, actually, CAD, CAM, digital twins, helping people build sort of construction materials over long periods, and probably also does the full life cycle, actually, of the buildings, not just the construction, but also, you know, the operation and the maintenance and all this. Is Autodesk now, again, an absolute category killer? Can you want to take us through this one? How you see that?
Yeah, so Autodesk is slightly complicated in a way that historically we have liked the company a lot more. So previously, you might have seen that Autodesk has been featured as our top 10 holdings in the fund, which would means it's high conviction. At the moment, you don't see that on our top 10 anymore. We have a much smaller position in Autodesk now compared to before. But it doesn't change the thesis that it's a category killer. It basically produces a software called AutoCAD for the likes of an architect or for people who work in the construction industry. And then that's a lot of information that you need to document in terms of what goes into a building. So historically, like, any house has been built maybe before the last like 30 years. Sometimes, most of the time, you don't know what has been gone onto that buildings in terms of spare parts. And if you need to maintain the building, like, that's very difficult for them to find the information. But nowadays, everything is all documented in terms of the spare parts, what has gone into that thing. At the same time, you do have this digital twin in terms of the, like, a 3D model that would replicate what actually is going on in that building. So there's a lot of modeling and understanding what's going on in a building. At the same time, there's this digital transformation that's been going on in the construction industry, is about building information management. So there's a lot of things that's now very systematic in term, compared to the back old days. You see people on a construction site, they might have this massive A3 or A1 paper, like a lot of papering around the site. But now you see people with an iPad and everything is on there. So that is what Autodesk does. I think what slightly make us having less conviction in the stock now is because the cycle that we are going through in terms of maybe there's a bit higher risk on recession, though Autodesk market is quite sticky because it's a piece of software unless you're firing your architect and other place, the people working in the sector, then maybe that's a bit concerning. So that is something that we are tracking closely. But the other thing, just to maybe flag it up here, at some point, I think there's a good opportunity for us to like it more in time, is about the reshoring opportunities. Mm-hmm. So they have a very high market share in the US. And if you think about, or if you follow us, that we've been talking about reshoring opportunity in the US, which means many new factories or foundries mm-hmm. being built. And of course, you would be using the Autodesk software to build a new site. So at some point, it's going to come through in numbers. But I think for this year, the risk of them maybe having less of that dynamics is a bit higher compared to, let's say, maybe in a year's time. So at the moment, it's not the highest conviction idea.
Okay. So just following on from that sort of foundry reshoring, move to the chip sector, which again has got sort of lots of different moving parts. You've had a number of players who have sort of flagged that we've had smartphones sort of like, you know, production decreasing, and not likewise with PCs. I think Microsoft has said that. But equally, you've got this reshoring into the US. You've got strategic, you know, building of chip and fabrications, and you've still got a pretty strong demand in things like all things EV. You've got ChatGPT, which is obviously driving AI and stuff like that. Let's start with NVIDIA, because it's sort of, I think it's almost doubled actually over the last sort of 6 months. It's done really, really well.
Yes, NVIDIA has remained one of our favorite stocks, or personally my favorite stock in the fund. And it's just one of those things about why we like about NVIDIA is we can clearly see 5 years or 10 years from today in that journey, throughout that journey, is we are going to need a lot more of NVIDIA's GPU to do different things. I mean, we would be talking about the hyperscale data center in terms of the analytics, about the real-time recommendation system. And then now recently, we're talking about the artificial intelligence that happened on a hyperscale data center through like ChatGPT. And of course, ChatGPT is only like a small subset of what could be achieved over time. But already it shows a lot of potential that this is the new world that we are going into. And a lot of this processing power doesn't happen on your PC. It would be on a hyperscale data center. So it will be stacked with a lot of NVIDIA's product, the GPU. At the same time, if you talk about automation, autonomous drivings, or 5G, that's a lot of things that NVIDIA will be able to achieve. And it was quite interesting that, of course, I think if you look at NVIDIA share price, it's still down quite a bit from the at the time. I think it peaked at about 800 billion. Now it's about 500 billion plus.
Yeah.
At the low was about 300. But if you were to ask me to make a bet which company would become the next $1 trillion company, I would pick NVIDIA that would be able to do it. So at some point, we would think that NVIDIA could double again. Of course, the timing is unclear. Is it going to be this year? Is it going to be 2 years from today? If you believe that the kind of the products that NVIDIA is giving the world that we need even more, that they could achieve that quite at some point.
No, I love that approach where you're sort of taking a long-term view, because short-term noise can sort of like disorientate investors. But if you've got a commitment to where you think the business is going to be in 3 to 5 years, that gives you sort of the North Star, doesn't it? To not get sort of like put off by sort of the daily gyrations of the markets and get sort of too optimistic or too pessimistic. Now, just the other ones on the semis, more on the equipment side, I guess. And this is the strategy, I guess, you know, investing in the picks and shovels of industries rather than actually the long-term sort of like winners and stuff, is Lam Research and ASML, which I think are, again, really strong sort of like semiconductor sort of like equipment manufacturers.
Yeah, so one thing that we like about these two companies on top of the technology side of the fence is about the reshoring opportunities. I think if you follow what's been going on in the world, that the semiconductors equipment companies would be one of the best play in terms of capturing the reshoring dynamics. If you look at the the amount of money that's going to be spent in terms of building new foundry, including equipment in the next 5 years plus, which the journey has already started in the US, in Europe, in Japan, in South Korea, that number amount to about $300 something billion.
Wow.
That's going to be spent in this space in building new foundries. And
yeah,
you already have seen plans going into the different parts. And I think recently that's a new foundry going to be built in Germany as well, which is a surprise given that they do have some crisis in energy, but it's coming onto Germany as well. So what it means is if you see, which is where the world is heading, is the risk to Taiwan is relatively high or remain high for the foreseeable future. And at the moment, TSMC is based in Taiwan, majority of their operation. Then you want to reshore that capability or the foundry capability back to the Western world. And if you follow what the US or the EU has done in terms of the tax subsidy, that's what they are doing. So what has been quite interesting or confusing is sometimes the shares of ASML or Lam Research would move negatively when there's a headline suggesting, oh, US is going to restrict the technology transfer to China. And then, of course, they are still selling a bit to China, not so much ASML, but Lam in particular, that the shares would react negatively. But if you really follow the story, that is part of the narrative. Without that restriction, why would the US be giving you tax subsidy to build a new foundry in the US or back closer to home? So if you put all this together in the next five years plus, we can easily see that they are going to sell many more of their equipments compared to the last 5 years, just because of the reshoring opportunity. So this is what we're looking at, is comparing the last 5 years going forward in the next 5 years. And if you follow ASML, the backlog they have now is about close to 2 years. So if you want to get a machine, the EUV machine, that you need to place an order 2 years before. For Lam Research, it's a bit shorter. So they haven't actually seen any orders yet from this reshoring opportunities. But in the next probably 2 years, then we would expect that to come through.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, certainly when it comes to organic growth, that's the place where there seems to be the pinch point for across the whole of the industry for the sort of the highest growth rates, actually, I think. And I think AMSL are predicting some pretty good growth rates even this year with smartphones and PCs down. So, yeah, on with you. Now, again, just shifting gears to cross industries, transports. We've got Union Pacific and Canadian National Railway. Can you take us through this one? I presume they're GDP plays, aren't they? I guess reshoring again?
This is reshoring again. So five years ago, we would not have been interested in the US railroads. This company have been around for hundreds of years. This is not new. It's not like we suddenly just come across the US railroad and think like, oh, maybe we should have a bit of that. It's all about the reshoring opportunities, because the closer we look, we realize that there's only one continent or one region that would benefit the most is the West Coast of the US, which link up Mexico to the West Coast and West Coast linking up to Canada. So these two railroads that we have in the fund is basically connect that strip in the US. And of course, people, this reshoring opportunity term seems to be quite a fancy term in itself. But if you look closer, no one is reshoring into China. People actually moving out from China to the likes of maybe Vietnam or India.
Yeah.
People actually moving out from Germany, with the exception of that new foundry that's yet to be built. But if you follow some of the chemicals company in Germany, the kind of state-backed companies, they are actually moving away from Germany because of the energy crisis. At the same time, I don't think many companies are coming to the UK as well because of Brexit potentially. So the only region is going to benefit is really the West Coast, which link mostly Mexico. That we could expect that many products that American get to buy in the near future would be made in Mexico rather than made in China, for example. So the railroads in itself would benefit. And historically, you're right, there will be GDP plus. But we would expect that with this, and on the back of that, we would expect more tax subsidies, just like the semiconductor space, from the government to back American companies or foreign companies to have a base closer to the US. And of course, that would generate a lot of activities in terms of how the things get transported from one one part of the country to another. So that is why we like the railroad. So we think going forward that the growth rate for this company would be higher compared to the last 5 years. And the other thing just maybe worth flagging is historically in a developed market, let's say US or Europe, it's all about consumer spending that is going to power the economy rather than industrial activities, in contrast to, let's say, emerging markets or maybe China historically. But because of the inflation narrative, that our discretionary income, disposable income would continue to be squeezed, not just by inflation, at the same time, higher level of interest rate, mortgage rate, at the same time, some kind of energy bills that are now higher compared to before, that we would expect industrial activities to grow faster or to contribute to a bigger part of those developed market GDP compared to consumer spending. So that is a trend that we would expect in the next 5 years. So 5 years from today, we would think historically, industrial activity would only form a small part. It would form a slightly bigger part, and the consumer spending would be giving share to those. And of course, the other thing about made in the US or made in the developed market, it means it's high inflation. Inflation means that it's more expensive to buy the product. So who is paying for that? The consumer is paying for that. So consumer going forward, like us, we would, even though that we might be spending the same amount of money, but we're getting less because made in the US or made in the UK or something. So those money will be going into the US railroads or some other infrastructure.
Yeah, well, you're in good company because I know Warren Buffett owns a US railroad. And it's quite an interesting point, actually, this whole sort of theme on reshoring, because it's sort of, I've been scratching my head from the US jobs report on Friday, because it obviously went up by 500,000. A large part of that was services. But what was the most puzzling for me was construction was actually up 30,000 on the month. And it's given it's January and they've just had a deep freeze. Then I thought that that's going to be an area of weakness. But actually, with reshoring, you could be seeing that first early signs of people breaking new ground on things like factories and all that kind of stuff. So I think you've really got a long-term secular grower there now. And just moving to the consumer, you've got Kering, which I think owns Gucci and Yves Saint Laurent. And I guess this is a sort of like a China reopening play, because I think the young Chinese love Gucci and leave solar on, I think.
Yeah, so we cover the luxury sectors, and at the moment, the only company we have in the fund in that space is Kering.
Yeah,
it hasn't been the smoother ride since we started position, which was about 2 years ago, just because that they have been losing some shares to LVMH and Hermes and other places, and of course we had the lockdown in China, which they are quite exposed to China. From here, we think that there's certain things that could change in the more positive manner for the company, which we're tracking closely. One is recently they have changed the designer for Gucci, which has been underperforming for the last few years. And then secondly, they have been doing a few things within the different brands that they have. And that there's some evidence to suggest that they are now going to recover as like a recovery play, that not just like a... They in terms of not losing more share to other peer group, or at the same time they could be gaining some share. So that is the medium term thesis. But of course, the shorter term thesis, that if you believe that Chinese consumer have not been spending a lot of money, just like when we were before in 2020, and then suddenly when the economy opened in 2021, which they didn't, then there's a lot of money going to be spent in some sort of enjoyment or buying things that they wanted to buy. So in the shorter term, I think they would definitely get a benefit from that. But the medium term thesis is not about China, it's about a resurrection of the Gucci brand and some other things that they have compared to the peer group.
Right.
So go on.
I'd certainly say, given there's going to be a deluge of tourists, certainly from China, then the sales of all things luxury are going to take off at the airports. That's for sure. With all that duty free, they're just going to absolutely go to the roof. They go to the moon. Now, just moving to financials. Charles Schwab is a sort of stalwart of the Blue Whale portfolio, a broker and asset manager, I think, wealth manager. Do you want to take us through this one? I guess it's benefiting from interest rates rising and with all the cash it holds, like all the asset managers, I imagine.
Yeah, so this goes back to one of the first questions that you asked at the beginning, that when when we started to make the changes in the fund was back in the summer of 2021, so about 18 months ago now. And then when the time that we recognized that interest rate is going to be at a higher level compared to the last 5 years, what we didn't know at the time was interest rate is going to get to such a high level, which is about 5% rather than maybe 3 to 4%. And that's why the fund didn't do well last year, or the market has actually collapsed last year. But we had recognized that interest rate going to stay at a high level compared to the previous cycle. And of course, one thing that we don't do, which some commentators would have made a lot of recommendation at the time, was to invest into banks. We never really get comfortable with banks because the complexity on a balance sheet that we never get to the bottom of things. Yes. Like no one can clearly build a model in terms of book value, because that's a lot of assumption that made.
It's a black box, aren't they?
It's a black box. So of course, any bank would have benefited from a high level interest rate, but at the same time, you'll be getting things that you might not want to see, which then is a bit of hit and miss, isn't it? We are already seeing that in certain banks that are still some scandals that's going on, or maybe have lend money to the people they shouldn't have. So Charles Schwab is the closest thing that we can get to. They would not only get the benefit of rising interest rate environment, that they pay their customers not a lot of interest for the cash they hold with them. At the same time, they can use the cash to invest into a higher yielding asset, which is mostly mortgage-backed securities in the US. And at the same time, you don't get the complexity of the balance sheet because it's highly regulated. It's just like your investment platform that they can't do much with their balance sheet apart from investing into mortgage-backed securities. So I think that is what attracted us to that. So what could happen from here? Of course, you would have seen certain people might have suggested that interest rate would be cut at some point later this year or maybe next year. I think the big question, though, which is our base case scenario, is interest rate could stay higher for longer. Despite that, it might be cut. Maybe it doesn't. It would peak at 5% in the US. It might get cut to 4%, but it could stay at 4% for the next couple of years rather than, oh, we are going back to 2% next year. So if it does happen that interest rates stay at a higher level for longer, it would imply that Charles Schwab is going to make a lot more money in the next few years compared to the last few years. The other thing just to worth to note for as far as Charles Schwab is concerned, while the interest rate has gone up now, but because the way that they invest their customer cash have a rebalancing cycle, so they would be able to reinvest certain portion of their balance sheet once every quarter. So it does take a bit of time for that to translate into profit. So the longer this drags on in terms of high level of interest rate, it will be very helpful to their underlying earnings. So we'll expect them to be making a lot more money in the next few years compared to the last few years.
Yeah, I'm with you. I actually think the bond market's wrong. I don't think the Fed's going to be cutting interest rates the back end of this year. Not after Friday's numbers, that's for sure. I mean, unless the market falls off a cliff, and if it does, then we've got different problems. But yeah, I can't see interest rates dropping materially, that's for sure, in the next 12 months. Now, just finally, sort of large cap, sort of like sleep at night defensive quality, Microsoft and MasterCard. I mean, these ones, I mean, what was sort of like stunned me was actually Microsoft came up with some negatives in its guidance and stuff like that, and there was a bit of slowing on its cloud for Azure, et cetera. But actually, by the end of the week, the shares had increased. So, you know, I think I was just wondering how are you positioning this within that portfolio construct of both, Microsoft and MasterCard?
Yeah, so I would take you through MasterCard and Visa first, which is very different to Microsoft. The reason that we like both of these companies, they are the net beneficiary from high level of inflation because they make money charging a commission on nominal spend from our perspective. And of course, if you follow the consumer spending in particularly in the US, that has been fairly strong. And even in the rest of the world, that has been fairly strong. Of course, if you look at real spending, that's gone down in the UK, but nominal spend has actually kept up. So they are in a very good position to capture that. As far as Microsoft is concerned, this is an interesting one. So I have got a chart that I plotted Microsoft share price since we launched the fund back in September 17 until recently. And the share price has gone up by about 250%, just maybe before the last 2 weeks, over well the done. Last 5 years, right?
Well done.
And then but what has been quite interesting about that chart is like if you put another line on top of that, which is the earnings, expected earnings in the next 12 months, let's say using the Bloomberg consensus since September 17 until now, it's equally gone up about 250%. So basically, the Microsoft share price has reflected the earnings power of Microsoft as a group over the last 5 years. But what was slightly confusing is Microsoft is still down about maybe 25% from the peak, was that throughout the journey in the last 18 months, the share price shot up a lot higher and then now has collapsed. But then if you look at the point-to-point performance of the shares and then the point-to-point delivery of earnings, that they have exactly delivered in line with that. So over the medium term, we do believe share price should trade in line with earnings power of a company. And then in the context of Microsoft, of course, is a widely followed company that any negative news would capture the headline, oh, Microsoft have missed on the earnings, Azure is growing slower and all that stuff. Yeah. But if you put Microsoft in the context of everything else in the market, is still relatively very high quality, that is net cash on the balance sheet. The number has been downgraded by a couple of percent. They are still making a very high margin in terms of what they do. And of course, as far as the enterprise users are concerned, including Bluewell here, it's like we are using the product even more now compared to before the pandemic, especially through Teams. There's so much stuff going on Teams that now we take it for granted because it's kind of free from Microsoft. But at some point, we know that we're going to pay a price for that, isn't it? Nothing is free. So that momentum has become a lot stronger. And the last point to make on this is we reckon that majority of the share price reset in Microsoft over the last year was due to the interest rate increases valuation contraction. So Microsoft now become cheaper because unless you think that Microsoft terminal value, let's say in 20, 30 years time, has gone smaller because there's a new competitor coming in because we no longer need their product, there's going to be a new era, etc., then you can't really explain why the shares has gone down 25% since sometime 18 months ago. The only reason would be interest rate risk. And then, of course, going forward, the interest rate is unlikely to go up or double again from here. It might go up a bit. Then it would then tie the share price back to the earnings power of Microsoft. So if you still, which is our case, is that we do think that Microsoft would continue to grow its earnings by about 15% a year over the course of next 3 to 5 years. So it means that the shares could start to recover, despite there's a bit of like an earnings downgrade shorter term.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard also that Microsoft's Azure, even though it's the second largest behind AWS, it's the best sort of like cloud platform, as I understand it, in the world. And adding in their investment in ChatGPT across the whole of that sort of software stack could really be revolutionary. I mean, who knows where it will give its competitive positioning in terms of advertising and with Google, and likewise adding that sort of extra AI, generative AI layer on that cloud with all its applications could be really sort of transformational. So we'll wait and see. Now, just one question, which again is on the Bluewell, which has been scratched me. Obviously, you look for secular growth and beautiful companies and winners. I couldn't find anything on the UK. Is it we're sort of devoid of UK sort of like, you know, top quality businesses? I mean, AstraZeneca obviously is probably the best, I guess. I don't know. I was just wondering whether why the absence of any UK businesses?
Yes, it's a difficult one because historically we have never had a lot of investment in the UK to start with. Mm. And then secondly, just because that we like secular growth company with secular growth drivers is typically in the UK, you don't find as many of those. And at the same time, because we invest into very large companies, as you outlined, that the average market cap of our holdings is over £100 billion.
Right. Okay.
Not that is the smallest holding we have in the fund, but typically, like in the UK, you don't tend to find many of those large companies, and liquidity is always an issue. And when you're running a fund that have a focus on liquidity profile of the companies, then UK is just not like a typical ground. Of course, I mean, we have invested into some UK company historically. At the moment, it's a different one, but then it's just not a typical area that we look at. And if even if you look at the composition of the fund, that given all the changes that we have made over the last 18 months, we are still about 2/3 in the US, which have really changed. What have changed, though, is the underlying composition of those companies have changed, that we have exited the FANG stock, which would be global company, American company, but global. And then we have orientated those proceeds into the domestic kind of play, like Charles Schwab, like the US railroads, which but they are still kind of North America centric. I think that is what we like. And at the same time, as far as UK is concerned, that we are definitely not, we're definitely very cautious about anything that's domestic in Europe, not just UK, but anything that's European centric or UK centric, we're very cautious. But of course, we do have some international company, and let's see what Arm does. Maybe if Arm gets listed in the UK, we could be interested. Yes, because Nvidia was trying to buy it at the time, so we could have
Our belt.
So we haven't got that. So we'll see what happened with the listing.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks very much for your time, Stephen. If investors want to put some money into Blue Whale, how best to do that?
So our fund is available on all the investment platforms, the likes of Hargreaves Lansdown, AJ Bell, or Interactive Investor. But if you would like to invest directly, you can come to our website, bluewhale.co.uk. And yes, so thank you for that, Paul.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thanks very much, Stephen, and look forward in touching base in 6 months' time. Big congrats, actually, on the year-to-date performance, because it's been very strong indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.